Hello, Matt.
Hello, Bill.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you, man?
I'm all right. I feel excellent. Like we're doing this on Thursday. We're doing this before the last Republican debate for the South Carolina primary. But even without the debate, I feel this is one of the most jam-packed days in Republican politics.
I like to tape this typically before a big event so that we look really stupid, no matter what. So according to plan, as we typically do, we're taping this before a huge debate. But, yeah, no, you're right. Huge day. A lot of stuff happening in the last couple of days, which is a little bit annoying, frankly.
There's some polling numbers coming out right now, and I think you got to throw them all out the window because there's no way you're going to factor in all that is happening and know exactly where the Republican primary electorate is going to stand. So you really got to hopefully people look at this with very clear eyes and said, look, we just don't know what's going to happen. Stop trying to be, psychics all the time and just, watch the show.
Right. I think South Carolina is going to be incredibly close. And as you mentioned, we have a debate tonight. As we're taping this on Thursday, Rick Perry endorsed Newt Gingrich. But also tonight there's supposed to be an ABC interview with Newt Gingrich's ex-wife, Marianne, which some have described as explosive. And we've already seen clips of it today where they talk about...
So what's the initial... obviously, we haven't seen the whole Nightline thing yet, but they've already teased out supposedly the most salacious stuff about Newt asking for what Marianne's calling an open marriage. Considering that Newt was getting ahead of steam this week after the last debate, do you have an early gauge on conservative blogger feeling? Is it, oh, crap, Newt's done it again, forget it, too much baggage, or is there a rallying effect saying we're not going to let the media land a cheap late hit on one of our guys right before, an election day?
I mean, I feel like more of the latter. We'll see. I mean, again, this could have an impact on him. But so far what I'm seeing and hearing, I mean, from people like Rush Limbaugh is sort of defending Gingrich against these charges the way that they defended Romney against the charges made by Gingrich's super PAC. So it does seem that some conservatives are now rallying to his defense. I think that it's seen as sort of baked into the cake. Everyone knew that he had... a past marriage that it ended, two past marriages that they ended very poorly. I don't know that there's really any new revelations to come out that weren't previously reported, maybe not widely understood or widely known, but at least previously reported. So at least for the conservative, opinion leaders, it seems like there's a little bit of rallying around Gingrich. It might also just be the fact that this is the last gasp effort to stop Mitt Romney. And if it doesn't work in South Carolina, despite the fact that he would have still only had just a minuscule number of the delegates needed, then I think, nevertheless, most people assume that he would be the nominee.
Now, this seems to be an extension of a rallying effect around Newt, added to what happened at the Monday debate, where Juan Williams, Fox News' Juan Williams, I believe the first debate panel moderator to actually introduce issues regarding race relations into one of these Republican debates, and Gingrich responded to him in the same sort of snide manner that he has taken with other moderators' questions that he deems to be inappropriate or distractions or what have you, sort of derisively calling him Juan, tripling down on calling Obama a food stamp president, dismissing any notion that there's racial overtones to that. And the crowd clearly ate that up on the spot, and it seems, and it's the point that Newt drove in the aftermath of the debate, cut an ad about it. And it seemed to sort of feed this notion of, this is why we like Newt. He stands up to those egghead liberal media elites and puts them in their place. Do you see a continuum over the week between that and the Marianne thing that's going to help Newt, come Saturday?
Well, I think the debate was a huge turning point for him. Debates are what elevated him, to rise from the ashes, a few months ago, you know, as he sort of surged in December, early December especially of 2010, I'm sorry, of 2011, right before going into the Iowa caucuses. And, of course, he peaked a little bit too early. But it was the debates that made that happen, and I think he recaptured that again this week. There were several highlights. It wasn't just the Juan Williams question, but I do think that was a great moment for him. I don't, you know, some people think that Juan Williams is sort of a token liberal at Fox. I mean, I actually think that it was a good question. I don't think it was a setup for Newt, but I think Newt did hit it out of the ballpark. And you know, I happen to think that it's, you know, not necessarily a dog whistle to talk about food stamps, when in fact, you know, more people are on food stamps now, and it's a reflection not of the people who are on them as being villains, but of the administration that caused them to have to go on it. But in any event,
there might be some debate which administration that was.
Well, we could get into that. But in any event, some people do see it as having some sort of racial overtone. I think it's like a little bit of a Rorschach test. You know, who you are determines whether or not you think that it was appropriate or not. But it worked politically in a Republican primary, and I think in the crowd obviously liked what they heard.
I mean, I guess well, one of the sort of political observation before I get into, you know, the heart of this dynamic. But it's interesting to me that obviously everyone seems to grasp that the only way you're going to stop Romney is for conservatives to coalesce around an alternative. You and I have discussed this in the past. It looked like that was going to be Santorum coming out of Iowa,
yeah,
getting this evangelical endorsement over the weekend. But it seemed like that debate moment, combined with some of the fallout that perhaps the process of that endorsement was not on the level, has made the Santorum endorsement seemingly meaningless in the eyes of the South Carolina electorate. There's really none of the polling that's occurred in the past week suggests that it's moved people towards Santorum. I mean, Newt's strategy has generally been, I'm not going to worry about campaign organization,
right,
IDing voters, getting people to the polls. I'm just going to have a few snappy debate performances at the right time, and that'll be enough. And it seemed like before Iowa, his good debate performances were too early. The last debates were 2-3 weeks before Election Day, so that strategy didn't work at the end. But these debates are right before Election Day, and that might be enough for him.
Well, and there were some debates, but I think that Newt, once he became the front runner, he started playing a little bit of the safety defense and became defensive, and I think he had a target on his back. So the debates heading into Iowa and New Hampshire, he wasn't the old Newt in the debates. But the debate this week recaptured that magic that he had when he first caught fire in, I guess, late November, early December of 2011. I knew that the, you know, I don't know if I said it here, but I certainly said a lot of places that the evangelical endorsements would probably be meaningless to Santorum, partly because it's, you know, these self-appointed leaders don't always have followers. And so I think that that endorsement was pretty much ado about nothing from the evangelicals in Texas. Santorum, you know, to win Iowa, went to all 99 counties. He couldn't replicate that other places. He gave a great speech on caucus night after winning Iowa. Then he goes, and by the way, as you know, it turns out it looks like he probably won Iowa.
In fact, the Iowa chair just said, I think 2 hours ago, yes, Santorum won. We're not even going to say virtual tie. Santorum won, period.
But, of course, that's stepped on all by the Newt stuff. Here's what I think.
Right.
A couple things happened to Santorum. One, he goes into New Hampshire, and he becomes embroiled with this college student in this debate over the gay marriage thing. And I think Santorum made a huge mistake. I mean, that's just sort of like the moment we can point to. But I think the deeper problem was that he should have continued to stress his blue-collar appeal and his very populist message about American manufacturing. I think that was a winning issue for him, and he didn't reinforce that enough. He didn't repeat it enough. He let other issues define him as opposed to being the guy. He should have, whatever question you ask him, he should have said, that's great, and I believe in traditional marriage, and one of the reasons I do is that it's the backbone of America. But right now, a lot of Americans are struggling, and that's why I'm working for traditional Americans to make sure that they get back to work, because getting them back to work will keep our families strong. That's why I have my manufacturing plan that will cut manufacturing taxes to zero and help, you know, in other words, segue everything into his blue-collar message. And he just didn't do that. He didn't have the message discipline to do it. Meanwhile, Newt Gingrich, say what you will about his attacks against Bain Capital, and it certainly had a backlash amongst conservatives, but it did elevate him to, you know, the one thing that those Super PAC ads and Gingrich's anti-Bain comments did was they made it about Gingrich versus Romney. And I think that really cut Santorum out. So, in other words, the attacks on Bain didn't work necessarily because the attacks resonated. They worked because they made the media focus on Gingrich as the number one enemy of Romney. So I think that totally sucked up all the oxygen and completely screwed over Santorum.
Wasn't there, I mean, I totally agree with everything you're saying.
Thank you.
But there seems to be a parallel in both the Santorum and the Gingrich campaigns in that they're both functioning as improvisers and not, you know, messengers. They're not, their campaigns aren't based upon driving a single message over and over again the way Romney is. Romney is more of a traditional campaign machine. This is going to be about jobs and the economy, and I have the experience in jobs and the economy, and I'm going to hammer that at every chance I get. Both Newt and Santorum essentially look for opportunities to get into arguments with liberals or perceived liberals,
right?
And try to milk those moments on TV. And one, Newt does it better than Santorum. He has more flourish when he does it. So they tend to work for him more. But in both cases, you don't totally control when those opportunities are going to arise.
Right.
So as you alluded to before, you know, Newt had debates in New Hampshire that he didn't have those moments in.
Yep.
And didn't get a lot of spark in. So he had that moment on Monday. Again, we don't know what's going to happen Thursday night because we're taping this too early.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
you don't know he's going to have that moment because he can't control. He doesn't know the questions that are going to come before him.
Right. And it's almost like in sports, having a good defense is important because defense isn't streaky. You know, you have teams that are streaky. They can hit, and then they go in a slump. And that's sort of how Gingrich is. I mean, it's not his – he lives off the land, but he has to wait for these opportunities, and he doesn't control his own destiny because these opportunities must present themselves before he can exploit them. I think that Romney – you're absolutely right. Romney is a great politician in terms of being organized and competent and having a great infrastructure. And I think, you remember there was like that debate where Rick Perry talked about bumping plans with somebody. And then
right.
They asked, like, who would you, like, if you could, like, didn't Perry say, I think I'd mate up Herman Cain with Newt Gingrich or something like that.
Right.
I think I would mate, the perfect candidate would be like, if you could have like Mitt Romney be like the campaign manager / chairman, okay? And then have like Mike Huckabee say, be the candidate. Because, you know, and then Romney would be like, all right, Huck, now we've got to get out here. I've got a fundraiser lined up for 2 o'clock. I need you to stay on message. These are the talking points. I mean, Romney is like great at the organization, at being competent, at being prudent, all that stuff. But he lacks the authenticity and the excitement. And so I really think that... And I've started to wonder, like, is there an inverse relationship between being, like, interesting and charismatic and also organized? Like, is it possible for the same person, for the same qualities to inhabit one person? Like,
well,
isn't it a
fact I would argue to you that that's why Barack Obama is now president, that he ran a very organized campaign but also had a lot of, you know, splashes of charisma and individuality to it. Didn't come across like... You know, the New York Yankees and GM, as they were once called. It's not rooting for a big corporation. You still had a sense of being part of something special.
That's a very good point, and I think you're right, except that I think you're right. You're absolutely right in terms of 2008. But don't you think that the sort of serious guy has now overtaken the exciting guy and even killed?
It's certainly hard to do it 2 times in a row, but I think the jury's out whether it is literally gone. And I, I would still argue that he has a lot of juice left to again be an organized campaign, but still have it have, you know, a spark as well. I mean, I think Obama is just a good politician, a good campaign performer. Period. Much as the way you could say about Ronald Reagan. So I don't think you can ever rob him of that wholesale.
Well, yeah, and you're right. The really great politicians can combine it, but they're rare. And it's almost like that Seinfeld episode where Costanza says that relationship George would kill independent George.
Right.
I think, you know, competent, you know, Newt would kill charismatic Newt. So, or independent relationship Newt might kill independent Newt too. so, anyway. I think that if we could bump these candidates together and mate them up, that it might be better.
But conservatives don't have that luxury, and it feels like because so much has been contingent on debate performances, so much has been contingent on, you know, is Newt on up or down day, or is Santorum on up or down day, that the conservative commentariat, both in the blogosphere and in talk radio, you know, they're engaging in so much whiplash, reacting to events, and not just picking. I mean, at this point, you should have seen enough of these guys to know whether you like a guy or not, you like his positions or not, you like his style or not. But instead, it's just constant reaction, and you literally have, you know, Rush Limbaugh going from, you know, a Newt hater to a Newt defender in a matter of days, and vice versa with Romney. Is that dynamic good for the conservative movement? Is the fact that the evangelical endorsement is snubbed so easily good for the conservative movement? Is it possible that none of these leaders really have followers if they're just constantly shifting with the wind?
Well, this is a common thread that we've talked about here before, but I mean, I am a firm believer in the notion that that leadership is not what it used to be. You know, we used to work at the same company for 40 years, join the same political party for your whole life. People sort of did what they were told and took orders, and you trusted your government and they would take care of you, and you trusted your company and they would take care of you. And I think that as we've lost trust in institutions, that we've all become free agents. It's as Daniel Pink wrote, free agent nation. And this, of course, is aided by the fact that we're, you know, empowered by technology, which gives everyone a printing press. Everyone, you know, it used to be like there may have been a point where if I thought a little bit too independently, I could be kept out. Like the Republican Party would shut me down, or the newspaper industry would shut me down, and I'd never work in this town again. Well, I could say whatever I want, and I'll just get a blog. I mean, you can't do that anymore. You can't enforce discipline. And so I think that these so-called leaders, they're only leaders to the degree that they can actually inspire people to follow them. And the old, you know, and a lot of them are self-appointed leaders. They don't really have followers. They're more interested in getting press or publicity. It's a sad state of affairs what's happened to the conservative movement. I mean,
But most of what you're talking about are the kinds of dynamics that people generally celebrate. You know, we're not a bunch of lemmings. We're not going to be told what to do. We have the power in our own hands. I can give a blog and I can say my own piece, and all that is true. But is there a downside to that for the Republican Party, in that if everyone is everyone's freelancing? And that means that there are no opinion leaders that are vetting candidates in a more thorough way than the average citizen can do.
Right.
That means you're left with these sort of snap reactions to the occasional debate moment. And that might lead a conservative to rally behind Newt based on a line like food stamp president, which might sound great to a primary electorate, but might not go over as well in a general election setting. So you're sort of losing any kind of, you know, sort of professional vetting
right.
That you might have gotten if there were leaders that people have still have respect for.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. And some of it is that that the leaders have disappointed us and deserve to be overlooked. And some of it's just that technology and forces have overtaken it. I definitely, and some of it, you know, but again, some of it is that our leaders, I mean, you know, the quality of our leaders in some cases aren't what they were. But I think that, you know, all these things are a double-edged sword. There's a lot of good that comes out of the fact that you know, some, you know, elite guy somewhere in some smoke-filled room can't tell me what to think and control me. But there's obviously like a downside to it. I mean, you know, if you're in the Marines and someone says, take that hill, and you're like, you know, I don't really think we should take that hill. You guys, if you want to do it, fine, but I think we should go this way. Right? You know, at some point, it does help if someone has the authority, you know, head coach in football, you know, Bill Parcells. The guy may be an arrogant bastard, but he's going to call the shots and you respect him. We don't have that. And so it is a little bit messy and it's interesting to watch.
Now, the non-improviser here, Mitt Romney, not being able to control his message this week, and that's sort of the downside of being a non-improviser. You don't necessarily handle things well when a curveball's thrown at you. You know, you alluded to the fact that, you know, even though there was some backlash against Newt for pushing the Bain arguments, they're still sticking to Romney, and they've been exacerbated by his wobbly answer about releasing his tax returns, and that has now led to Romney having to admit that his effective tax rate is a lot lower than what his income level would normally require, because his income is largely through carried interest and capital gains and not by earned income. And you're having follow-up reports about how he's parking his money in the Cayman Islands, and that might come out if he has to go back and release more tax returns than just this current year. You know, there initially was a rally around Romney effect, saying, hey, let's not put capitalism on trial here the way Romney tried to frame the argument. But as this tax return stuff comes out, is there a concern amongst conservatives that this – I didn't even like this guy in the first place. Why do I want to take all this baggage along with it if I don't even like like him on policy?
Right. So I think that, you know, a couple issues that we could talk about here. One is the actual policy of it and the actual merits of the, you know, the deal he got. And the other is the optics. I mean, as I've said before, I think the optics are very troubling, because Obama, I think, wants this race to be a class warfare race. And I think Mitt Romney is tailor-made to be the rich Republican Gordon Gekko. So clearly this is problematic from that standpoint. In terms of the 15% thing, I think Jim Pethikoukas really nailed it the other day at his blog.
Now, who's he?
He is a blogger for the American Enterprise Institute. He used to be at Reuters. And he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said basically, if you think that the biggest problem in America is income inequality, then you should be upset that Mitt Romney only paid 15% capital gains tax. But if you think the biggest problem in America today is that we don't have enough jobs and that we need to jumpstart the economy, then you should be outraged that he paid anything, because the capital gains tax should actually be zero. I mean, here's my thing. If you want people investing more in America, which presumably would be good for the economy, then taxing that less should be smart, you know, smart economics.
Well, this is what I don't understand, because that's generally what conservatives say when these issues come up. Why be afraid of a tax return? And if you are comfortable with those arguments and those positions, I'm not saying you personally, because it's not your tax return, you know, why not lay it out and say, look, I'm a wealthy guy. I'm a job creator. This is what I pay taxes on. I think this is, I would be investing more of this money if there were no capital gains tax at all. Of course, that's not Romney's position. Romney doesn't believe in cutting the capital gains tax more for the wealthy. He's had a more nuanced position on that point. But he's for cutting taxes on corporations. He's for abolishing the estate tax. You know, he could be making that sort of argument. Or he could be making a status quo argument saying, you know what, this is a relatively low tax rate, but that's good because that means more of my money is being invested back into the economy. Why be afraid of that if you believe that resolutely in the position? It would seem you'd only be afraid of it if you would think showing the actual numbers to that position would not buttress the argument.
Well, I think that most Republicans believe that is true, but they also know that it's bad politics. They know that it's easy to play the class warfare game against them, to demagogue the issue. And back to the optics standpoint, Romney has made many errors in this regard. The $10,000 bet with Rick Perry. The other day, he said something about like, you know, I didn't make much money. It was a very small amount or something like that that I made giving speeches. Well, it turns out it was like $300,000 or something. So he doesn't think that's much money. So he's made a series of these sort of errors, and then the latest is, and I don't even know the details about this yet, the Cayman Islands stuff. Have you, Bill, followed that?
There was an ABC report yesterday saying that a number of his Bain money is parked in the Caymans, and that gets preferential tax treatment. But I don't know to what extent they are. I think they're taking a certain degree of information from SAC filings, but perhaps there'd be more details about it if his tax returns were laid on the table.
Gotcha. So anyway, let's talk about you want to talk Perry or Marianne or what do you think's the next big thing that's impacting this race?
I assume the value of Perry leaving is just that it's just narrowing the field. I mean, his actual number was not that big.
I would actually disagree. Well, maybe I agree. I agree with you. His number wasn't that big, but I think because his number was not that big, I don't think his leaving the field is the big news. I think it's the sort of buzz that it gives Gingrich with the endorsement, because I think that what it did was it nullified the other story we're going to talk about, the Marianne Gingrich story. So I think there was more of a PR win than it was an actual, you know, number of voters win.
Right. I mean, I think we're saying the basic same thing. You know, I don't know if I get personal credit for this. I probably don't. But I put out a tweet earlier in the week saying if I was Newt, what I would say is, hey, if you vote for me, and at minimum, this campaign's going to continue.
Right. Right.
If you don't vote for me, the conservative vote's going to split, and Mitt's going to win. This campaign's going to be over.
And Sarah Palin, by the way, that was essentially what she said
right.
when she on
well,
Hannity.
Well, started saying that a couple days after I tweeted again. It could be coincidence. I mean, maybe it was the most brilliant insight in the world. But I thought it would be novel for a candidate to say that bluntly, to make a strategic
right.
vote argument, because that's not normally done in politics. Normally you're arguing your positions and your vision and all that sort of thing. But I thought it, for conservatives who are so befuddled what to do when their vote's being split that Newt could get away with a strategic argument
yeah.
like that, he made it, then Sarah Palin made it, and then to have Perry come out and endorse Gingrich, you know, sort of implicitly affirms it, and I think gives conservatives a taste of what it might be like if the field got really winning, if you really
yeah.
went one-on-one with Romney, you know, not taking Paul seriously because he's probably taking his own campaign seriously at this point. So I think the optics of that, seeing that debate tonight with fewer people on stage, a cleaner shot, more
yeah.
time between the front runners, I think it's all – I mean, it might have gone Santorum's way if people took the evangelical endorsement seriously, but they didn't. You know, now Gingrich can plausibly say, hey, I'm your only ticket to ride here if you want to stop.
And since Gingrich is the best – ostensibly the best debater, more time – presumably helps him more than other people in the debate. Let
right.
me also give major props here to Eric Erickson at Red State. On Wednesday, he wrote a piece at Red State saying Rick Perry should drop out and endorse Newt Gingrich. Drop out before South Carolina. He can either be a spoiler or a kingmaker. Eric Erickson wrote that on Wednesday. I emailed one of my sources at the Rick Perry campaign, and they said Rick Perry is 100% committed to be, you know, to being the nominee, and you know, they totally gave me that BS spin.
Right.
You have to. 24 hours later, Rick Perry drops out. Now, here's the interesting thing. Rick Perry launched his campaign in Charleston, South Carolina, in August at the Red State gathering. 6 months later, after Red State basically tells him to get out, he drops out in the same state. He endorses Newt Gingrich, the guy who, as you'll recall, when Newt Gingrich's campaign was floundering this summer, his staff left en masse, and the top advisors went to Rick Perry, who at that point was, you know, the front runner just entering the race.
He has the best job creation record in America. How could he be stopped?
Well, it is kind of amazing, if you think about it, that he did so poorly. I mean, I was totally stunned, because I really expected Perry to do a lot better and to give Romney a real run for his money. It's astonishing if you think of, like, again, he launches his campaign at the Red State event in South Carolina. Now, 6 months later, the day after Red State tells him to get out and endorse Newt Gingrich, he gets out and endorses Newt Gingrich in South Carolina. And again, couple that with the fact that essentially Newt's staff abandoned him when he was down, say staff and advisors and consultants, to go work for Perry. It's a really interesting story, and frankly, I don't think the media has talked about this that much.
Basically, Eric Erickson is to Rick Perry as Walter Cronkite is to Lyndon Johnson.
Yes, I think so. That was more Vietnam, though, right?
Right. When Cronkite reported from Vietnam and essentially said that this war is not going anywhere, Johnson said, "If I've lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost America." So
yeah.
Clearly, Rick Perry said, "If I've lost Eric Erickson, I've lost conservatives."
Maybe it's a coincidence.
Must make Eric Erickson's heart grow so large.
Maybe
his head.
You know, who knows? Maybe it's a coincidence. Maybe they tipped him off that this was coming, and he just. But whatever the case may be, I don't think that this has been discussed that much. And you know, if you want to talk about blogs and blogging and all that, I mean, again, this I think shows a little bit of the muscle of the conservative blogosphere, that the front runner at the time, the guy who, you know, totally undermined Michelle Bachmann, when he announced on the day she won the Iowa caucuses, the Ames straw poll, at the Red State a gathering of bloggers, which I think has not been widely appreciated, and then he drops out of the race after the RedState.com and Eric Erickson, the top guy over there, says get out and endorse.
But how many decrees has Eric Erickson made over the course of the last 12 months that have been totally ignored by their targets?
Oh, I'm sure several. That's a good point. But usually it's not this specific, though. Like,
no, I imagine Perry and Red State seem to have a bit of a relationship, so it wouldn't shock me that Eric Erickson's post, you gave him a nudge, but
yeah.
Erickson seems to try to play this kingmaker role or puppet master all the time, and I think tends to, you know, push the string more than he pulls it.
It's fair enough. I mean, I'm sure we could go back through and look at times where they've told people to do something or predicted things that didn't happen. Fair enough. So let's talk about the professor.
I found amusing that there was a lot of talk after the Drudge Report came out with the gossip tidbit about the Marianne Gingrich interview. I saw some conservative tweets saying, you know, this shows, you know, Drudge can make the world stop on a dime. And I saw Chris Hayes from The Nation, MSNBC, said, what shocked me about this is that I realized that people still read Drudge. I didn't realize people read Drudge anymore.
You know what, man? In defense of Drudge, if he when he links to you, it is unbelievable. I'm not breaking any new ground here,
sure,
with saying this, but it, you know, I can attest to the fact that if he links to something you write, your traffic explodes. A lot of people.
He still has his core audience, but I would say that his ability to move news has been greatly diminished in recent years. I mean, this is the first Drudge siren event we've had in a long time, and this did not require Drudge having a siren to make news. ABC could have dropped this 24 hours later and make a splash without Drudge. Drudge wasn't the linchpin here. He just happened to scoop it first.
It is interesting. I mean, to me, what I found interesting about it was that here's something I noticed. Drudge puts that story up Wednesday night, and it was huge on Twitter, and it led me to believe that it could be a game changer. Remember, this is before the Rick Perry endorsement, before we knew that was coming. Newt had been surging, and it definitely struck me as something that could stop his momentum. I get up this morning and I turn on Morning Joe. Now, I didn't get up at 6 when they first come on Eastern time, so maybe I missed it. But I watched from like 6:30 till 7:30. And they never mentioned Marianne Gingrich. All they talked about was all the trouble Mitt Romney's having and how he's lost his momentum. And
I mean, this raises the question, who is going to exploit it? You know, what candidate is going to take the ABC interview and hold it up and say, this is the reason why you shouldn't vote for Newt?
Well, if anyone does, and I'm skeptical that anyone will, because, again, they could, you know, it's not quite as bad as the Bain thing because it's not hitting Newt from the left, but there is potential for a backlash. But, I mean, it, obviously who's most well-positioned to do this might be Rick Santorum. His last gasp effort to win South Carolina or be the only other guy standing.
He's the inventor of marriage.
And he invented marriage, so that's good. So, yeah.
Santorum presumably has nothing to lose. He's got to knock Gingrich out if he's going to be the conservative alternative. And sanctity of marriage is right up his alley. But I haven't seen him, you know, get that personal on this issue yet. And I don't know, he would totally get away with it if he tried.
And by the way, let me just point out something I wrote about at the Daily Caller, which is not exclusive to me, but I think I maybe pointed it out or brought it up again more than other people have. Marianne Gingrich in 1995 gave an interview with Vanity Fair magazine, and she said in 1995 that if Newt Gingrich ran for president, she could derail his bid with a single TV interview. He can't do it without me, she said. I told him, if I'm not in agreement, fine, it's easy. I just go on the air the next day and I undermine everything. I don't want him to be president, and I don't think he should be. That's what she said in 1995 when they were married. So I think she might have telegraphed this one. Mental note, never piss off Marianne Gingrich.
Perhaps we should leave it on that note, sir.
It's a high note. It's a very high note.
I don't want to say something that's going to get me in trouble.
All right, man. So anyway, just to recap, we have not seen the debate. So don't. If something earth-shattering happens, maybe we come back and we retape. I know that's exciting. But this thing is in flux. And I'll say right now, flip of the coin. Who wins South Carolina?
Flip of the coin. All right. I want to give it to Newt. I'm going to predict
Newt.
You're
going to predict
Newt. Why not?
So he got hot. It's like going into the NFL playoffs. You always bet on the team that gets hot late. So.
But before we go, I want to mention the other important news that you are going to be on Real Time with Bill Maher this weekend.
That's right.
I don't have cable, so I don't know when the show is on exactly. Is it Friday or Saturday?
I believe it airs Friday night. Check your local listings. but it's on.
Don't you have to be there when it's airing? Don't you have to know?
Well, I don't think it tapes. I think it tapes. I don't know that it airs live. I think it.
Oh, really?
It may be. I think we like tape it like 6 p.m. Pacific time, and then it airs like an hour later. So I don't think it airs exactly live. I could be wrong. And I don't mean to break down the fourth wall if I am. it'll be interesting. Obviously,
who will you be on with?
So I'm on with Jennifer Granholm, Buddy Romer, and in the last segment, special guest Bernie Sanders. So
it's a cavalcade of stars.
All hardcore right wingers.
So you don't get any Hollywood in that mix, unfortunately.
No, although I'm actually a little bit happy about that because I think that it's one thing to go up against three or four people who are in disagreement with you. Although Buddy Romer is a Republican, it's one thing to go up against two or three people and a host who disagree with you. It's another one to go up against someone who's like a rock star that the audience loves. I mean, I'm a rock star, but I mean like a literal rock star that the audience loves. And especially, what would be really annoying to me is someone who's like a celebrity who's like doesn't know the issues, and yet they get all the applause, and like, you know, I'm losing to this guy. To me, that would be like the worst. So I'm kind of happy that these
That's
are
That's
what
all, I hate about Victoria Jackson.
There you go. There you go. So I'm kind of happy that it's you know, somewhat political people.
Excellent. Well, don't miss that. I will find a way to pirate it somehow before SOPA passes so I can watch you.
Well, I plan on putting – I'm going to tweet out some of the video or put – assuming that I don't look horrible, I'm going to put some of the video up. So at
excellent.
Some point.
Yeah, you should get that Daily Caller place to post some clips.
Yeah.
Stop sleeping on the job. Start promoting your people.
Well, you know, there's a fine line between self-promotion and shameless self-promotion. And so I try to delicately walk that line.
Well, have fun. Have fun in L.A.
Thanks, man.
Fun in Hollyweird.
Out on the left coast, you know.
And we'll see you next week on The Week in Blog.
You got it. See ya.